our third the governor's budget hearing. For the benefit of those on the phone, my name is Matthew Maylove, and Governor Dean Duke is incoming budget director. And I'll invite those here in the room to introduce themselves, beginning with Representative Weiler.
Representative Ken Weiler from the Finance Committee.
Representative
Max Dellum, the Governor's current and outgoing budget director.
Excellent. Thank you, everyone. We may also have state reps and state senators joining us via the phone. We'll look down for questions throughout the morning. For those on the phone, I do apologize for the acoustics in the room. The rain today may further exacerbate those challenges, but we'll do the best we can. With that, I would like to call the Secretary of State's office up to begin their presentation. Good morning. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning. I'm David Scanlon, Deputy Secretary of State. It's nice to be here on this rainy morning. We just completed a very challenging election cycle. Which is still ongoing. We've got a ballot which will be 9 o'clock, so those are like the next steps. And then we're done the 2020 election. But really, the only thing that I have to say about the budget for the Secretary of State is that there are no changes to it in terms of increases in our expenditures. We have put together an efficiency budget that has been guidelines that the governor proposed, and it's a straightforward plan. So probably the easiest thing to do is to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Mr. Scanlon, do you have any questions for the Secretary of State's office? I guess I would start by saying good job on the election. And this was unique for a lot of reasons, but I think it's an understatement to New Hampshire did exceptionally well. All things considered. Do we have any questions for the Secretary of State's office? Dr. Zella.
Thanks, Dave. Can you talk briefly about the various divisions you have? I'm specifically interested in the security division and both the security revenue that you collect as well as penalties.
The Secretary of State's office has five divisions, administration, elections, corporations, securities, vital records, and archives and records management. That's six. With the Division of Securities, the Bureau of Securities, they register broker dealers that operate in the state of New Hampshire. They also license mutual funds and other financial products that are offered in the state of New Hampshire, and in doing that raise, I believe it's in the range of $40 million a year. The agency is self-funded, and they do that by fines that they collect. They get to retain, $725,000 from one year to the next to be able to cover their operating costs for the year. The operating expenses are paid by fines that they collect, and they range from $725 up to several million dollars, depending on the kind of litigation or engagement.
And those fines are relatively uncommon, right? We always have fines, but some years we have particularly higher penalties in favor of the state than others. But what's the rough average kilo of penalty and fines to the state?
Yeah, they always cover their operating expenses through fines. But beyond that, the amount they collect ranges. I don't know that I could give you an average, but it's not unusual for them to have settlement that is in the $2-4 million range. And those funds lapse to the general fund after they cover their operating expenses.
Representative Weiler, a question. Isn't there also a registration fee for the funds, multi funds? Isn't that part of their income? I thought that was fairly steady.
That is fairly steady, and they register financial instruments, stock funds, mutual funds in New Hampshire, and then they register broker dealers that operate in New Hampshire, and those are the funds that generate $40 million, and they go right to the general fund.
Yeah, I don't want to have the impression that everything is fine, because some of them are registration fees, and I think that's a major part of it, if I recall.
Yes.
Thank you.
One question that I do have, and this is Matthew Mailo again, I'm noticing two items on the unrestricted revenue, page 6, Blue Sky License and Blue Sky Miscellaneous, seem to be two of the more substantial line items in the budget. I'm just curious if you can speak to those in a bit more detail.
I believe those are the registration fees that are collected in the securities side of the fall.
Those are the funds that
are sent to Wilder. Those are the agency funds. Could you give the answer for that? Those are the funds that President Wilder was referring to.
Thank you. Anything further? Do we have any questions on the phone for the Secretary of State's office?
If you have a question, please press 5-9-4.
While we're on that, Director Zell.
Just a historic question. The Board of Act auctioneers, why is it at the Secretary of State's office?
That's a good question. I don't know if I know the answer to it. Other than it was not unusual in the past for miscellaneous agencies to be officially attached to the Secretary of State.
Would it make sense to move it to Office of General Licensure and Certification with other state boards, or is there a nexus?
We do have, we produce the licenses and we have staff that provide the testing, which has traditionally been and done through our department. Years ago, it came to us and we traditionally kept that in our office.
You could probably move up to that other table so she could get my microphone. So people on the phone could hear her.
No questions on the phone. If there's anything further, I'd like to thank you both for the presentation this morning. Again, great work with the election as always. And appreciate the time this morning.
Thank you.
With that, I would like to call the Boxing and Wrestling Commission forward to begin their presentation. Good morning.
Paul Penny from the Secretary of State's office, where the Boxing and Wrestling Commission is housed as well. Commissioner Bobby Stevens sends his regards. He might need to be here today, so I will speak on his behalf. Boxing and Wrestling is another board that has been traditionally and historically attached to our office for many years. They govern the boxing, just as they sound like the boxing and wrestling events that are held in the state of New Hampshire, as well as in recent years, mixed martial arts, which has started to be more popular around the country and in the state. Make sure the boxers and slash watch are fit. They have to have blood testing, physical rather than pay fees for them, what their fees that are associated, revenue that's associated with that, and that comes into their budget. You can see it's pretty small. Having that in our division helps hold down your expenses. It's not a competent budget for us, so it's a good arrangement for all. Commission Stevens did indicate what with the pandemic, things have been less busy, but they have still had some events, so there have been Twitter records from that, but not as much as traditionally since the spring.
Thank you. One question, and this might just be a matter of the scope of what this commission does. I don't see any full-time employees dedicated to this initiative, but is this something that shares resources across other staff and Secretary of State's office?
Yes, yes. We don't have any specific staff for that. We just have our own staff take care of their instances as they arrive. There are three commissioners that are paid a per diem per event. They get mileage to travel to the event, but our staff and Secretary of State's office handles the administrative process.
Thank you. Any further questions for the boxing reference? Director Zellman. Hearing 2 years ago, Commissioner Arlinga correctly noted that the boxing reference commission produces revenue for the state and that every agency collects boxing reference. I just wanted to reiterate that. I'll concur, Commissioner Arlinga.
I just wanted to say, it is not my expectation that every agency has the ability to produce more revenue than this. But they do a great job, and you know, probably keep us passionate about things in America.
We certainly are.
We're very lucky.
Do you have any questions on the phone for the Boxing Wrestling Commission?
If there are any questions, please press the button on the card.
Seeing no questions on the phone, like thank you for the presentation. And hopefully we see more or less like this COVID dates.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call forward to judicial counsel. But we actually are ahead of schedule, so we're looking to wait 5 minutes until the notice is 8:50 to have them begin.
Good morning, everyone. We'll come back in session here at 8:50, and we have the Judicial Council ready for their presentation. If you'd be able to introduce yourself to the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning. I am Sarah Rogers, Executive Director of the Judicial Council, and I wonder if I could have permission to speak my math up on.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the last part of that, but
thank you so much. For those of you who couldn't hear me, it sounded like I was talking into a pillow. I am Sarah Rogers, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Judicial Council. The Judicial Council's responsibilities have evolved over the years, but overseeing the quality and the cost effectiveness of the Indigent Defense Program continues to be our core mission. The council also provides for legal and guardian ad litem services in child protection cases, and we enter into public-private partnerships for civil legal aid. The council is made up of three full-time employees, including myself, and the cost to run our agency is roughly 1% of our overall budget. And in the handout that I provided today, on page 4, some of you will be able to see the breakdown of that, and I apologize, they may have gone overboard in frugality, like only made 5 color copies of our pie chart. So this will be very apparent for some of you, and some of you will have to struggle to see that breakdown. I apologize for that, and we'll be happy to provide more color copies. Our expenditures are driven by uncontrollable and often unpredictable factors, including the number of child protection and criminal cases brought by the state. We are very grateful for Governor Sununu's continued support of indigent defense needs and the needs of all of the other programs that we work with. And I just wanted to say that all the programs that we work with, the Public Defender, CASA, and Indigenous Legal Assistance, have done an incredible work providing services, as they always have, to some of our most needy folks in the state, despite the unprecedented challenges of the pandemic. The state funding for indigent defense fulfills the constitutional requirement to provide criminal representation to those who cannot afford it. Indigent defense accounts for roughly 85% of our overall budget, and the Public Defender Program is the backbone of indigent defense in the state of New Hampshire. Our efficiency budget maintains level funding for the Public Defender in both fiscal years 22 and 23. At the beginning of the pandemic, we did see a dip in new criminal charges being brought, but at the same time, pending cases are staying open longer. That's for a variety of reasons, but perhaps the biggest driver of that is the fact that courts were shut down for a period of time and the jury trials are now being pushed back. The issues that the typical public defender client suffers from, like substance abuse and mental health struggles, have really been exacerbated by the pandemic. We anticipate that in the months to come, more folks will actually be eligible for public defender services as we continue to face the economic fallout of the pandemic. The contract attorney program is the statutory backup for the public defender, and these attorneys handle about 14% of the indigent defense caseload. So they are reimbursed on a flat fee basis, and they are only given a contract once they have been approved by our Indigent Defense Subcommittee. Our efficiency budget maintains low funding for the contract attorneys in both years of the biennium. Our assigned counsel accounting unit pays for the representation of indigent defendants in criminal cases, and it also pays for accused parents in child protection cases. In fiscal year 20, criminal representation accounted for less than 20% of our overall cost. And as you can see in our handout on page 3, which is a history of our expenditures from 2014 through 2020, our cost for child protection expenses have gone up quite dramatically. again, our efficiency budget maintains level funding for both years, and based on recent trends, we do believe that this will be adequate. However, I should note that this is an unpredictable line, especially with the criminal representation, and it is impacted by factors like the homicide rate. For our services other than counsel budget line, we are asking for an additional prioritized need for both years. For fiscal 22, that prioritized need is $480,129, and for the second year of the biennium is $467,996. Counsel will only pay for a service if a judge has determined that it's necessary for an adequate representation of the defendant as required by the Constitution. This includes costs for expert witnesses, for transcripts and translators. Even with the additional prioritized needs, this would put us below our fiscal 20 expenditures. Although we've seen a significant increase over the past 6 years, expenditures have actually increased by over 50% between fiscal 14 and fiscal 20. We believe that we are starting to see a slow but steady decrease in these lines. Fiscal 19 was the peak, and we have several complex cases that are winding down, so we expect that these costs will not be as high as they have been. The other piece of our budget that really has been on the rise is the cost of the child protection cases. And I realize that you've already heard from child advocate Moira O'Neill, and our handout includes an op-ed piece that she had in the Concord Monitor several months ago that speaks very eloquently about the challenges facing children during the pandemic. We are certainly expecting an increase in child protection cases, and that will translate to an increase in expenditures of judicial counsel. Parents are facing heightened anxiety and stress from lost income. Kids continue to be isolated because schools are not met all in person, and we are expecting that once school is fully in person and people are interacting with children, that there will be a significant increase in these cases. But we are not sure when to expect that. Our efficiency budget for CASA maintains level funding for fiscal years 22 and 23. As many of you know, CASA is the preferred provider of guardian ad litem services in child protection cases. Their advocates receive extensive training and supervision. And unlike a private guardian ad litem, there is no fee cap that prevents them from spending as much time as they feel is necessary with a child. In fiscal 20, CASA advocates provided over 77,000 hours of service to these children, and they drove over 500,000 miles as part of their work with these children. This time commitment alone, if we can pay for private guardians of lighting, would cost the state over $4 million. Despite COVID, CASA has continued to aggressively advocate, train, and recruit volunteers. The non-CASA guardian ad litem, the accounting unit pays for the private guardian ad litem when a CASA is unavailable for a case. Our efficiency budget maintains level funding at $150,000, but for each year of the biennial, we have an additional prioritized need of $150,000. And again, you can see on page 3 of our handout that these costs have increased significantly over the past 6 years, and because of the anticipated increase in child protection cases going forward, we do expect that we will have to pay more for the private guardian ad litem services. Our guardian ad litem accounting unit 1092 has level funding for both years of the biennium. We are requesting additional prioritized needs of $241,950 for each year. This county unit handles a variety of services, including guardianships for incapacitated adults and minors, and representation for parents and termination of parental rights cases, and the guardian ad litem in the termination of parental rights cases. That is just the private guardian ad litem. If the CASA was not the underlying case, they will also handle the termination. But we have seen a significant increase in that piece of this accounting movement. And parents, I think, have really been struggling to get services during this period of time. And we are expecting that as these cases increase, that we will also see more termination cases. And that's the justification for our additional prioritized needs. As many of you know, the council also serves as the task group for the state's commitment to civil legal aid needs. Our efficiency budget maintains level funding for New Hampshire Legal Assistance at $1.5 million for each year. New Hampshire Legal Assistance is on the front lines of cases that have been and will continue to be impacted by the pandemic. This includes housing relief, employment security, and protection from domestic violence. And these are all areas that the state has prioritized through its COVID relief initiative. We've always understood the importance of assisting people with basic human needs like housing, but the last several months have illustrated that keeping people in their homes also serves a public health need. Not only does it keep individual families safe, but it stops the homeless shelters across our state from being overburdened. New Hampshire Legal Assistance's response to the pandemic has been both nimble and effective. They recently created a crisis response fellowship, which is a public-private partnership with private law firms in the state of New Hampshire that has allowed them to maximize their CARES Act funding. This has provided three new attorneys who will be with New Hampshire Legal Assistance through the end of December of this year, and those attorneys are working on housing and unemployment cases. But I think the impact of the pandemic has made us all very aware of people who are on the threshold of falling into poverty, and have deepened certainly my understanding and appreciation for the work that New Hampshire Legal Assistance does for our most vulnerable residents in this state. Thank you so much for your time. I'm happy to take any questions you may have, and I would be happy to put my mask on if you would prefer.
Thank you, Director Blodgett. Do we have any questions for the Judicial Council or Representative Ober?
Thank you. We have heard from Warder O'Neill, and while I appreciate you attaching her article, I have read the last two reports. The first one that came out when Commissioner Myers was still here at HHS failed to make any mention of a bill the legislature passed for 27 new DCYS staff. The most recent report did not mention the fact that the legislature had budgeted in DCYS some wraparound services as well as more staff, as now Commissioner Chivinet could probably speak to, although I know Joe Ripson, who is the director over there, could. I would urge you, and I didn't hear any conversation you might be doing that, is somehow getting the guardian ad litem some information from Director Ripson about additional wraparound services, which are designed to help families before they get to a crisis mode. And I think that's one of the things you could help with, because while you see families as they enter crisis mode or they're having problems, you may also see families who could benefit from some of these services and get some synergism. So it's more than just throwing more money at a budget, but just helping the people and using all the resources. So, Sarah, I know how hard you work, and I would ask that you add that to your plate and take it on and see if you can't provide wraparound services that prevent some crisis that some families are going to have.
Yes, certainly. Thank you for the question, Representative Ober. That's an excellent point. I think, especially over the past several months, there's been more of an understanding of the importance of an upstream approach to these cases, and we are in a good position to be assisting with that. Thank you. I will certainly follow up.
All
Representative Hyland.
Thank you, Madam. Director Blunkett, when we set your budget, we understand that there's a lot of unexpected things that will come forward. So we always expect you to come back to fiscal to get additional funds. Now, when I see the history here of your spending, have you added that monies back in under adjusted authorized, or is this just what was budgeted at the beginning?
So in this history, it is not what was budgeted at the beginning. This history is our actual expenditures for those years.
Thank you very much. That was my question.
Thank you. And I'm sorry that was not here. Thank you.
Director DeBong. Thank you, Sarah. I have two questions. One is on the Insular Non-Council Services. We discussed previously some changes that some of the licensure boards were pursuing that would drive up significant costs to the Judicial Council and the state, and also impede quick access to services for the clients we serve. Can you give me a brief update on where those changes landed and if we were successful in abating?
Yes, thank you for the question, and thank you for your assistance with that. So one of the services that we get invoices for on a fairly regular basis is for mental health evaluation, and it could be a competency evaluation or a psychological evaluation. And these are often provided by a forensic psychologist. The state of New Hampshire does not have a large number of forensic psychologists available to do this work. And a concern that came up recently is that the Board of Psychology rules and regs require that a person who is coming to New Hampshire, even if it is just to do an assessment, not to provide actual clinical services to a patient, but to do an assessment for the purposes of a criminal matter. Depending on the length of time it takes to conduct that assessment, has to be licensed in the state of New Hampshire. And the public defender and I have reached out to the Board of Psychology to talk about creating an exception for individuals who are coming through to that assessment only. And we reached out right before the pandemic exploded, and we have not been able to connect with the Board of Psychology yet. They are aware of our concerns. I spoke with now the executive director of OPLC about that, and she understood and was very, very willing to help us come up with a resolution to that. The concern was that it would be harder to get these experts to come into the state, and that the experts may say to the defense attorney, I'm going to need to charge the cost of getting a New Hampshire license because I'm only doing this to provide an assessment of this particular case. And so at this time, I don't have a resolution to that, but I hope to shortly.
Thank you for that. That would have a material impact on both the cost for similar non-council services that would drive up the market rate. I believe there's only two forensic psychologists, and at least one of those two individuals sits on the Board of Psychology. And also would delay getting psychological evaluations, which are necessary as part of our standard procedures before we process the client.
That's exactly right. It's not just the added cost, but it is also the delay, and that can be significant. There's a process that has been described to me by one of the psychologists we have this issue with. It's very time-consuming.
It's a barrier to justice. Thank you for that. And then my second question is going to the various, the difference between the assigned counsel and the public defenders. Why don't we staff up half the public defenders as opposed to bringing in kind of additional support out of time?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, please?
Why don't we staff up at the public defender's office so to they can need to bring in outside counsel? I see Michelle shaking her head in the back.
The cases that go to both the contract attorney program and the assigned counsel program are cases that the public defender has an ethical conflict with.
I see.
So they can accept those cases under the rules of professional conduct.
Understood.
So we actually be able to say, okay, is the case we have open a more or less serious case, and they will have the less serious case go to conflict counsel. But it's only those cases that go out to the other two tiers of representation.
Okay, so it's not analogous to our relationship between CASA and CAS?
Correct.
Okay, for sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Armas.
I'll note that my next question is something's never changed. I think that question probably comes up every budget hearing. I think you and I talked for like 20 minutes about it 4 years ago. And I suspect 4 years before that, and 4 years before that, and 4 years before that, people talk about that issue. It's a phenomenon. I wanted to highlight what Matt did to the CASA so everybody realizes that the incredible value that the state gets from CASA and the fact that so many more people do that. This is a nonprofit agency that is not remotely a state agency, and it's staffed by volunteers. And if they went away, we'd be doomed. I think that's a fair statement.
Yes, especially considering that the services they provided in fiscal 20 would cost us well over $4 million.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. We raise from CASA is not possible. Thank you.
I know where you think it's on the phone, and I will second your comments because I don't know what we would do without them.
It's a big thing, so thank you, Marty. The thing I wanted to ask about is Representative, one of them, I forget which one now, said about you coming to fiscal every year. And you come to fiscal, there's a footnote in the budget, which is important to stay there because when people are entitled to representation, whether it's not a choice that we have, that's something we have to do. How often did you have to do that this year? And based on kind of where trends are, there's a temptation sometimes to under budget on purpose, knowing that, they can just go to fiscal and get the money later, like there's money hanging out to get later. Are we close?
We are close, and I just want to say, I think Governor Sununu and all of his budget directors have been very helpful with truth in budgeting, especially with regard to our budget. And I think that historically there has been that temptation, and I think it is certainly a fallacy to say that, when we're looking at our budget numbers and say we can make do with half of what we had for actual cost in the previous year. But with the caveat that this is all a guess, and my best guess is consulting with Nina Gardner and Christine, my predecessor, what we've put forward in this budget, I believe will have us going to fiscal less frequently. Now, I know that they love to see me there, and I certainly love to go. But I think we took a hard look at our cost that increased significantly, a 60% increase over 6 years is a huge increase. We had cases like the Addison case, and we had a number of cases where there were juveniles that were sentenced to life with a possibility of parole, and those cases had to be relitigated in terms of sentencing. And so those cases ended up having a significant impact on our services other than the counsel line. And who knows what will happen in the next biennium? There will be another U.S. Supreme Court decision that requires us to relitigate. There's only so much that we can do to accurately predict what these costs are. But based on what our spending has been, the trajectory has certainly been on the rise in almost all of our lines. We're starting to see decreases, and we think that in certain areas we are past the peak and trending downward. And that way, I believe this reflected in the budget that we put forward. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, that's
perfect. I believe I
and just approved me 3 or 4 times, but I thought people here were going to correct me. I think there's a slight possibility they got sick of seeing my face there.
That seems extraordinarily unlikely.
I would concur with that. Just one question to follow up on Commissioner Arlington's question. To what extent, if you mentioned that we're past the peak in some of these cost increases, to what extent are these national cost drivers, like the Supreme Court decision, versus the extent that they're unique to New Hampshire?
That's a very good question. I think that in terms of the criminal cost, part of it was national because those cases were, the sentencing of those cases had to be relitigated across the country. But the Addison case, because it was the first death penalty case that we had had in such a long period of time, was certainly unique to New Hampshire. Because we don't have many individuals who are qualified to handle death penalty level cases, we have a public defender who did an absolutely outstanding job in our representation of that individual. But for the appeal process, we didn't have anybody in the state who could handle that. So part of our cost for that case were travel costs from the out-of-state attorneys who had to come here to represent that individual on his appeal. The child protection costs, I believe that there was really a perfect storm. That was the opioid epidemic that had a significant impact on these cases. There was also a change in the law that allowed for a rebuttal presumption of neglect if a parent was misusing opioids, and so that allowed more cases to go forward. As Representative Ober mentioned, the increases in staffing at DCYF have allowed them to bring more cases forward as they look at all of these allegations that come before them. And I think certainly in terms of opioid impact, the future has certainly been very, has been hit very strongly, and that has rippled through child protection and our criminal costs. Sorry, I don't think that was a very helpful response.
No, but the context certainly is helpful. Thank you for that. Do we have any questions on the phone? While we wait for that, Director Zellman.
One final question, if I dare French make it just sitting behind you. For E-Film, is there a potential for a partnership with the Department of Health and Services to bring in additional federal funds to support our services to our clients?
That's an excellent question. Thank you so much for asking it. Yes, I'm working very closely with the Director of Film to try to access Title IV e-money. And this is a relatively new initiative by the Fed that will allow us, without taking money away from DCYF, this will allow us to bring in funding to the state based on our cost for parent representation in the child protection realm. And we have been talking with other states that have been able to get this money. They've had their agreements in place. Joe and I have reached out to the regional directors, the Children's Bureau, and it's some stumbling blocks there, but we are continuing to try to work with them and to learn lessons from other states that have successfully accessed this funding. And this money is meant to enhance the representation, but as you see from these numbers, from the conversations we've had in my nature of statistical, the need is huge. And we had anticipated, based on the initial formulas that they were providing for guidance of what states could see, we were hoping to get between $200,000 and $300,000 additional dollars per year to help with the parent representation piece. Thank you for bringing that up. And we're continuing to work on it.
And if that's not, if we aren't able to figure that out with the federal partners and the governor's state, I'm sure the legislature would be happy to have that discussion entertained.
Anything further for Director Blodgett? Seeing none, I'd like to thank you for the presentation and I look forward to working together.
Thank you all so much for your time.
With that, I'd like to call the Department of Health and Human Services.
That has to be the HHS today, the largest packet.
That's because computers have written papers, don't you know that?
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. It's great to see you both. If you could just state your reference to the name, your name to the record, and then begin your presentation.
Laura Schumann, Commissioner of Health and Human Services. Chairman Madden, Chief Financial Officer of Health and Human Services. Thank you. I am going to be deferring to Ms. Brown for the majority of the presentation, and she knows the best. We will both be available to answer questions. I just want to do a couple of opening remarks. Our mission at the HHS, most of you know, we are the biggest agency in state government. It's not only to care for vulnerable populations in our state, but also to operationalize the program for the vulnerable populations to live independently. In addition to a programmatic investment, the department needs to maintain an administrative, technological, and personnel infrastructure that allows for an effective and efficient implementation of this program. For the past several years, we have done a great job at reinvesting in our programs. We've seen this with mental health, we've seen this with SUD and DCYS. While we need to continue to invest in this program, there's a lot of work to be done there. There is a lot of infrastructure needs that need to happen at the department that we need to continue to operationalize those programs. Things like technology in our MMIS system and our variety of systems that serve as Medicaid, DCYF, our developmental disabilities, and on and on and on, our public health department. To be able to continue to execute those programs, those investments are very much needed. We have deferred maintenance on many of those programs for years and years and years. The same goes for deferred maintenance of some of our buildings, and then deferred maintenance, and I'd like to call that, although it doesn't fit with the technical definition of our personnel, both in the number and in the skill set that is required to run a department as big and as complex as the HHS. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to present, and I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Brown.
I'm going to have you just go ahead and turn to slide 5. I think the Commissioner adequately covered slides 3 and 4, and we can come back to this later if you want to read through them. Slide 5, if you've been to these before, you'll notice that the presentation is eerily similar to last year. We try to stay consistent with the information that we're providing you. These are the selected caseloads. You'll notice for fiscal years, not fiscal year, these are calendar years, I'm sorry. For these calendar years, for 21, the unduplicated caseloads and Medicaid caseloads are much, much higher than previous years. This is because of the enhanced FMAP and the requirement to keep people on Medicaid through the period of the enhanced FMAP, which at this point is expected to go through until at least March. Additionally, you'll notice that there is a significant decrease in SNAP caseloads over the past many years. The most significant of the change being around 2017-18, when there was a change in the TANF eligibility, which drove more people to TANF and less people to SNAP. Additionally, the increase in unemployment payments is counted towards income. Excuse me. And because of that, the SNAP caseloads are also lower currently. Just for informational purposes, on slide 6, there is an organizational chart. Since the last presentation, really not much has changed there. Excuse me. On our current staffing rates, we have just under 3,000 positions. This includes the positions that were added in the last legislative session. I would note that we do have a high vacancy rate right now due to the housing freeze. Over on slide 8.
I'm sorry, Karen?
Yeah.
Are these positions full-time, or do they also include part-time?
I'm sorry, these are only full-time, this does not include our part-time position.
Thank you.
There are, I think, it's over 100 part-time positions. Some of those are related to 100% of the grant funding type part-time positions. On slide 8, I do think that we want to go through this entire budget book today, so what I've done here for you is just roll up by division. The second handout you received is the Appendix A, which is our chart of accounts, if you will, in accounting terms. And on that Appendix A, I have indicated what accounting units belong to which division. There was a large reorganization two bienniums ago. We've slowly made some changes as those reorganizations have stayed in that manner. But there are still some accounting units that are part of a larger group that we have not yet broken out. So that's the reason for the layman of Appendix A. The Medicaid budget, which is our largest piece of our budget, ironically also the fewest number of accounting units, has been budgeted as though CFOs return to pre-COVID levels by July 1st. There is also a prioritized need for if CFOs do not return to that level. But in an effort to meet the governor's target, the level funded that essentially to CFOs pre-COVID. We did make reductions, although you do see an increase in general funds from the fiscal year 21 appropriation. Most of that is due to caseload drivers. We did make reductions in several administration areas, including organizational dues, equipment, consultants, temp positions, in-state travel, and out-of-state travel. Another thing of note is DCYF is fully funded in the efficiency budget. Looking at the chart, it appears that there is a reduction, but that's because we have moved the Medicaid expenditures for DCYF into the Medicaid budget. So that is the reason that you see a reduction there.
I'm sorry, Karen.
The movement of Medicaid affected multiple divisions and programs within HHS. The hospital as well.
So we made that adjustment in fiscal year 20 and 21 that New Hampshire Hospital used to receive DISH directly as a federal revenue. That now flows through Medicaid, and New Hampshire Hospital receives it as another revenue. Slide 9 is familiar, I would say, to almost all of you in the room. This was the diagram I created when I started with CHHS to help visualize what finance looks like for the HHS. And it is that combination of budget and actuals and cost allocation. We did budget differently for 2021, starting from revenue. Because of the continuing resolution, that did create more complication in our ability to use that. But we landed in a place at the end of fiscal 20 that I'm very happy with, and I think we're on a really great path to continue improving how we budget. On slides 10 and 11, I've included a handful of the prioritized needs. This is not all encompassing. One of the things that you will notice is several of these things were funds that were included in the fiscal year 20 and 21 budget, but have not been implemented. There's a couple of reasons behind that. The continuing resolution brought us to October 1st, and then projects started to begin, RFPs being written. Those were completed just in time for a pandemic, at which time most spending was put on hold. The first of that being shelter funds, which is a match for a state plan amendment to support for supportive services for people experiencing homelessness. The second is the homeless street outreach, which again is included in the current budget. Both of those are and was held when COVID started, and this is to support street outreach for unaccompanied
the court, for youth who do not have an adult with them. The third one I listed there, I incorrectly listed New Hampshire Hospital. It should have just been one. So there is a hope that the staffing contract will reduce some overtime, which is why it was removed from efficiency and put into prioritized needs. And I think through the phases, we will get a sense of whether or not that's working and be able to have that discussion. The last is tobacco prevention. Again, this is something that was in the 2021 budget but has not been spent. A 2017 report showed that 41% of youth in New Hampshire have tried e-cigarettes, where the national average is about 11%. So these funds would pay for further research to determine the best type of outreach and prevention campaign, and would also pay for some of that outreach and prevention campaign. Over on slide 11, so on slide 10, those are more programmatic prioritized needs. On slide 11 are some of the administrative prioritized needs. The first one I know Matt is very familiar with, we've had many, many discussions, which is the TANF MOE. There's about $800,000 in the prioritized needs for TANF MOE. We are required, and Mary's probably listening, she's going to tell me if I say the wrong number, but it's somewhere around $32 million in general funds that we have to budget for TANF MOE. The second one is the annual rate increase for state phase down, which is the Medicare Part B clawback, also known as dual eligible. The typical rate increase is 2-3%. The unfortunate part about this, and Representative Over still appreciates this, we never truly know how to budget it correctly because they don't notify us until October 15th of the fiscal year when we are in it, but the rate increase will be. You will notice, probably on the next
slide. Sorry, Karen. This is a federal program dictated by a federal formula that is inherently unfair to New Hampshire. That's correct.
It is a federal program dictated by a federal
formula. Okay, I'll say it's my opinion that the way the formula is construed, it doesn't match our good efforts at cost reduction. It's put us on a glide path, I think, based on rallies in 2002. So, the cost here in no way reflects the work of the state or the department, and in no way, like, we don't have any control.
Yeah, this is based on a very good economy year in the state, around 2010. You will notice, probably on the next department wide transfer at fiscal committee, that I am transferring funds out of this current budget to cover an under-budgeted issue in DCYF. What I would note is that state phase down was not over budgeted for 2021. The enhanced FMAP also applies to this fund. Interesting. It applies as a credit. So there are additional funds in 20 and 21 that are unlikely to repeat in 22 and 23 unless the public health emergency continues.
Okay. Karen, just ask the fiscal committee to just have that on Friday. That's already done, right?
No, so that transfer was for personnel-related items. This transfer that I'll be doing the department might for DCYF is their programmatic dollars.
Thank you.
So that concludes my presentation. Like I mentioned, given the size of the budget, I'm trying to stay very high level, but I'm happy to take any detailed questions.
I'd like to thank you both for the presentation. Do we have any further questions for HHS? I'll extend a courtesy to those in the phone at this time as well.
If you have a question, please
come back. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Karen. When I think about HHS, I usually think of it as public health, Medicaid, economic housing supports, and our DD program. Would you agree that that's roughly a good way to kind of programmatically break up the department if you were going to break it up from, not as an organization standpoint, but mentally thinking about how programs interact? There's so much overlap in what you do, and obviously DD is related to Medicaid, and obviously both on Medicaid are also really direct on mental health support. But when looking at program areas, does that also kind of
It's roughly an average of your organizational chart.
So, sorry.
I'm not sure where you would put CCYF, mental health, FTD in all of those areas, but if you have an umbrella that you can put them under, perhaps.
So, as we're seeing, obviously, everyone's familiar with public health is doing at the moment. They're a little around the front lines, a little busy, but as everyone is. But as we're seeing increased caseload on the Medicaid side, how is that translating to the additional programmatic costs and wraparound services we provide on economic housing and economic and housing stability? Because I would say that Medicaid enrollment increases is kind of like the bane in our thing. We anticipate seeing additional utilization for other services. DD is more tied to the state population and those services. I don't know if the pandemic will necessarily have a change on utilization of those services, but economic and housing stability, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think from a legislative standpoint, there's a couple of areas of the budget that I always worry about, you know, that come with the economy driving it, right? It's Medicaid cases, but it's also cash assistance cases. So things like CMS have a block grant. So there's only so much funding available there. So if the demand starts to become more than the funding, then we have to fund that general fund. I'm also concerned about the behavioral health, mental health system. I think, and the commissioner could speak to this more than I can, but we're seeing entrance into that system that we've never seen before. I think the pandemic, you know, quite frankly, has caused, you know, struggles with my own mental health. You know, so when you look at how that's affecting the population in Hampshire, we're going to see increases in caseloads in that area. And if they're on Medicaid, that's great, but we also can program for the uninsured in New Hampshire, because the more we are able to fund that kind of a system, the more we can keep people from entering New Hampshire hospital and costing $1,300 a day. So those are the areas that I'm concerned about as we move forward, but certainly it can have an impact on every area of our
Absolutely. We've looked at our wait list. We've seen, and as we've known for several years, we saw record high several years ago, and we hit down to zero in March for our senior boarding list, and now we're back up again. We're seeing record numbers of kids in the emergency rooms waiting for beds. And what is really eye-opening is about 50% of the people waiting for an inpatient bed are people that have never been part of the system before.
Thank you for that. I guess the root of my question is, we started your presentation kind of early on, we talked about increases in enrollment and our Medicaid program. And I've always appreciated the way you deduced, but also provided the unique enrollments for the various programs on the health side. I guess I'd be interested, I know Ms. Steele is trying to phrase Representative Ober, I'd be really interested in a crosswalk, and you don't necessarily need to provide this to me, it's something we can format into the legislature, is as we're watching enrollment changes in our other programs, where someone's kind of path through our health and community services system is, and what we can do earlier on to abate the cost that we know will occur when we don't get to this. I know that's something the department's always talked about, and does a good job about it, but I think the pandemic has really necessitated a pretty comprehensive look at where we can intervene early to make future costs, but also enable that first coverage.
I think the other thing that I should have mentioned when we were looking at the chart of the cost of the vision that is a driver of cost increase is the 3.1% rate increase that happens on 1/1/21. There's only 6 months of that reflected in fiscal year 21, and now it needs to be reflected for 12 months in fiscal year 22 and 23. So that's also part of the driver for the increase in cost of programs like Medicaid. So it's not all people addressing.
One question I would have, and thank you, Karen, for the presentation thus far, that I guess is on, you know, the IT capabilities of the department. Especially when we start talking about higher caseloads and higher enrollments, given the high vacancy rate, does the department have the efficient tools
during active scale, or are there additional investments that the state might be able to make just to help triage some of these different pressures that are popping up in different areas?
So I think, as the commissioner spoke to earlier, no, we don't have the infrastructure we need in the department at all. And I think that that has hindered our ability to be efficient. I would say that we need staff and money to implement those things, right? And those are sometimes the two things that are holding staff being able to move in that direction. And the second part of your question, I'm sorry.
No, I think that was it. I mean, if we can't necessarily hire people, whether it be workforce challenges or cost allocations, other investments we can make, IT to make each individual person more efficient, I think you spoke to both. I do not.
Okay. I would also add that our capital budget request, I know it's not this hearing, but you've given me an opportunity, so I will advocate. I believe that there were at least 15 IT projects on that capital budget
request. Definitely noted, and we'll take another look at that. Do we have any other further questions for you, please? Commissioner Arnold?
You noted there were 15 IT projects. Do you know how many building requests there were?
There are several of those, too. That was the other thing that the commissioner spoke to. We have a severe deficit in keeping up with deferred maintenance. I forgot that there was a number produced for just in Central Hospital not that long ago on the amount of deferred maintenance in that building, and it's astronomical. They still have carpet in that building when it was first built. I know people refer to it as the new psychiatric hospital. It's 20 years old, and the carpet's still the same. So, yeah, there are also many projects related to buildings, you will notice on that last page of my presentation, I do note on there that there are several prioritized needs for deferred maintenance items and IT. So,
I would just note, as a general principle, the state is increasingly spending its capital budget on more and more on IT projects, and our deferred maintenance across the state enterprise, whether it's prisoners and state buildings and HHS buildings, continues to skyrocket, and capital funds are increasingly diverted to computers. Just a note, you had posed upon you recently, somebody I don't actually know the genesis of it, a multi-million-dollar consultant coming from one of these outside consulting firms. Theoretically, it's going to look at your operation and tell you how to make everything so much better. And that group has a report that was due at the end of October, but I think hasn't come and has been delayed. You know, and it's delayed too. It's a report that's going to be public, and if there's anything in it that's going to be useful for the budget process.
So the first draft of the report is being reviewed currently. I think that it is going to inform our next steps for many budget cycles, not just the current budget cycle. And I think that what you will see is that to implement many of the things that they're recommending, and we sat with them, Karen was the lead on this, we sat with them to report off probably weekly, so we understand what the recommendations are coming out, because verbally we've been provided updates. What you will find in that report when it does become available is that in order to implement anything that will be able to provide efficiency and effectiveness, there needs to be an investment in both technology and personnel. And that's pretty consistent across the department and across all recommendations.
And just to add, for administrative purposes, that contract has been extended to 12:30, so it did not end on 10:31. That should be on a GMP agenda sometime in December as an informational item.
The report will, or the contract?
The contract to extend it to December 30th.
Will the report be a public document?
I don't think it's finalized as well yet. And I would just expand on what Commissioner said to say that I think what you'll see is transformative and not
And just to clarify, that before it was with CARES Act funds. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Which I guess leads into another question. I know the state has made various investments with the $1.25 million in CARES Act funds to the department. Would you just be able to speak to some of you maybe the best uses of funds the department has seen during the public health emergency?
Sure. Unless the commissioner answers that, I would also just ask that the department receives directly from the CARES Act over $100 million that is not part of the $1.25 million. So the investments are broader than just the funds moved over. So obviously, everything that CARES Act is directly related to our COVID operations. So the vast majority of our dollars have gone to personal protective equipment, so PPE. I think there's well over $60 million in that area. And then widespread testing. We have done an astronomical amount of testing throughout the state and had to stand that up basically on a dime. There was no existing infrastructure for that. We have also been able to upgrade some of our public health infrastructure to be able to do the report out that you see. We did not have the infrastructure in public health to be able to report out the numbers you see, the data you see. The dashboard did not exist a couple of months ago. So all of those things had to be set up very quickly because we did not have an existing program that allowed us to do that. We're moving from, COVID management and testing and hopefully into mass vaccination operations in the next couple of weeks, at least phase 1A, and then full community vaccination probably in February or March. There has been a lot of movement to be able to stand up the systems that enable us to do that. As you know, the immunization registry, which has existed in every other state for decades, only got approved in New Hampshire this past biennium. So we're scrambling to try to set that up so that we are in a position to be able to better track and manage our vaccination program that will be coming in the coming weeks.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I'd like to thank you again for all of the work that you've done throughout the public health emergency, and I know the people in New Hampshire share that credit too as well. Our representative over the question.
Thank you. Karen, because I'm still not physical, I know open financial, you have done a yeoman's job at trying to get things budgeted in the right bucket. So when you finally come to the House with the budget, most of the members have not had the opportunity to sit on fiscal and hear all the work we've been doing. Would you please bring the crosswalk so that it makes it easy to go through because it will just cut down on the questions and understanding? I know you've just really worked very hard with this for 2 years.
Absolutely. I think the Appendix A that I provided you is the best place to start with that. And my intention is as soon as the chair is named that I reach out to the chair to make sure that we can come up with a plan that works for presenting and make sure that we have the right people there at the right time.
Thank you, Karen. Commissioner, I'm glad that you were studying up for vaccinations. I know that Pfizer submitted all their paperwork to the FDA last week to get that vaccination approved for public use. I'm hopeful we can because I think most of us are getting COVID fatigue.
We're expecting the first doses of Pfizer vaccination by the end of the year. Those vaccination doses are going to be prioritized for nursing home residents and the people that work in nursing homes. That's where we have seen the most negative outcomes of COVID-19 in New Hampshire, along with critical health care workers and first responders will come after that. And then hopefully on to community vaccination sometime in late winter or early spring.
Thank you, Commissioner Director Dunlap.
I want to respond to something that Commissioner Arnold has said and relates to statewide, but also very much to your department when we're talking about the capital budget. And I think the state of New Hampshire has, over the last number of years, increasingly tried to focus on operational costs, and deferred maintenance, and getting our operations and our facilities where they need to be. Unfortunately, due to prior actions a decade or so ago, the state's credit card have been run quite high. So while revenues have been strong pre-COVID the last couple of years, the level of bonding has functionally remained unchanged. And as capital expenditures go up, price of steel, the life of me, I cannot understand why IT products cost what they cost, but every IT product seems to be going up. So it's not necessarily that we're doing more IT projects than capital projects. It's we're doing the same rough breakdown between IT and capital. It's just we're doing less projects, and we're not increasing our bonding to do more projects, or they're capturing additional costs because we're paying down the debt the state had previously taken on. And so it's just an unfortunate reality for fiscal management a decade or so ago. And I guess, you know, we'll do everything we can on the capital side, we'll do everything we can on the operational side, but it's just the reality we're in. I agree. We need to invest in IT, we need to invest in facilities, but we have constrained capacity.
I think that, you know, and I just want to comment on that, Mac. I agree with you that we need to budget within our means. But what happens, and we've seen this over and over again, specifically with healthcare facilities, you don't have the option of not fixing things when they break. And it becomes much, much more expensive to be reactive to a broken HVAC system or water system or a building deterioration than to do the proactive maintenance that is required on them. We have, you don't have an option of closing a New Hampshire hospital wing or Lentless. They have very complex, federally regulated systems that need to be upgraded and maintained. So the reactive approach is going to be more expensive in the long run.
And I absolutely agree. We implemented a deferred maintenance fund as a last budget to start to try to get after those sorts of expenses. And I'm not trying to make excuses for the way the situation we find ourselves in. It's just, I think we all recognize that we need to do more on deferred maintenance. We all need to invest in systems that will help enable us to better respond to the next crisis and be more efficient and better prepared. We just have constrained resources, so we have to make strategic investments in the future as we're also making investments in our current systems, our HVAC. And Charlie's department, I think, has increasingly taken the lead on trying to address deferred maintenance. And the commissioner was a great advocate for that, but Charlie made a comment that we're spending more and more on IT, and I just wanted to make the record clear, we're not spending more on IT and less on buildings. We're spending roughly the same percentages. We're just doing less because costs are going up and we're not increasing the amount of spend because we're paying down our state debt.
I just want to look at that research and then what that's true.
I think we spent $35 million in IT in the last three capital. It's been about $35 for the last three capital.
Okay, still getting a lot of questions. I would just also note that we did establish a very small tiny maintenance fund, which hopefully will spend $1 million a year once we get done with the pandemic, because it hasn't spent any yet. And then we have deferred maintenance we reduced, or I have calculations of $100 million since we stopped counting, because there's no point in counting, so we're not going to fix anything. So it's probably 2 or 3 times that easily. I go to my office and stuff that I don't have to get fixed. I got other stuff to do, and I can do with 3 lights instead of 4. And it's just another few. But I would note that the maintenance fund does not affect, does not for the use of patient occupied buildings. So the need to be at your hospital, et cetera, are on top of that too. So maintenance is a broad issue in the state, and, you know, the commissioner is exactly right, and it's a common. Right, that's a comment that every commissioner sits here could make. And quite sadly, the answer to all of them is, yeah.
So, Charlie, should we have 2 maintenance funds, one for patient buildings and one for others?
Senator Rosenwald asked us to look at that in the last budget. I think there's actually language in the budget that we were supposed to look into. And I think that I think the difference is that for the for the buildings that the DAS administers, so the roughly 90 buildings that we administer, they're the, you know, the class 28 that are done, and it's not class 28, but some that mechanism. The similar mechanism is based on the same kind of formulas. And that makes sense because what we're doing is amalgamating revenues from a variety of sources and variety of departments into a centralized fund, which will look at, you know, where are the department issues. To do that for New Hampshire Hospital, though, we would end up charging New Hampshire Hospital 25,000 square foot and putting it into a fund for New Hampshire Hospital. And it's you're not robbing Peter to pay Paul, you're robbing Peter to put money in Peter's other pocket. And or whatever the right term for that is. And so the question is then whether or not we can amalgamate a little tiny bit of money from a variety of sources. But, you know, there's a source and there's a destination. And so it's kind of the same thing. It's something where we would just have to decide in a budget cycle when it was time to do so, that there was money available for it.
There's a reporting requirement. The report was due at the time that I was acting commissioner, and unfortunately it did not hit my priority list at the time. And shortly after I commissioned acting commissioner, COVID happened. So I was not able to produce that report, but what Charlie is saying is it's pretty much accurate that to create that fund, I don't know if it would be effective to have DAS administer the fund, because we administer maintaining those buildings. So we would create a fund within DHHS, New Hampshire Hospitals, primarily general funds. There is some DISH, like I mentioned earlier, as part of that budget. We're not sure if that program would allow us to use those funds to create that type of future fund. LANCIS is general funds and half Medicaid funds. Similar question there that we did not finish researching, but we're not sure if Medicaid would let us create that type of fund. So, and then FYSC, which is 100% general funds. So we absolutely could create those funds. There would be some kind of revolving funds, and it, to be most effective, it should be 100% general funds, and then we would pull the federal funds as the project was completed. So the funds would increase, but I don't think we could pull the federal funds and put them into that account prior to the expenditure.
Representative Wilder, the
question. It's more of an observation. We're trying to flat fund everybody in this budget. Sort of recognizing this is officially about a 2% inflation rate, but at the rate the feds are printing money, I think it's easily twice that. And that's the challenge we're all faced with, trying to make a budget and wondering why all the prices, especially like say IT, keeps going up. But I think the real inflation level, if it wasn't for someone stifling it at the official level, is really a lot higher. That's what making all our jobs so tough, trying to react to things, but we don't know why this went up so much. But it
did. Thank you.
Any further questions for AHS at the moment? Seeing none, I'd like to thank you both for your time, and we'll continue to align this moving forward and look forward to working together. With that, I would like to call the Community Development Finance Board, the CDFF. Good morning. You can state your name to the record and then begin your presentation.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm Katie Easterly-Marte. Good morning. I'm Katie Easterly-Marte. I'm the Executive Director of the Community Development Finance Authority. Thank you for this opportunity to address you regarding our
one line item in the State Treasury Department's budget for fiscal years 22 and 23, which is New Hampshire's required match for administering the Federal Community Development Block Grant Program. We are a state-chartered, independent nonprofit organization, and as such, our board of directors is appointed by the governor and council. As a state authority, we are among a handful of unique entities that work in partnership with state and federal initiatives to strengthen New Hampshire's community through the distribution of resources to municipalities, nonprofits, and businesses. I am here to request continued match funding from the state of New Hampshire in the amount of $400,000 over the next biennium. The request of $200,000 per year represents the federally required match of state funds towards program administration of New Hampshire's annual allocation of federal block grant resources under the CDBG Balance of State Program. The Department of Housing and Urban Development uses a formula to allocate CDBG resources, and if funding levels remain similar to the years past, we anticipate New Hampshire's community development block grant allocation over the next biennium will be approximately $18.63 million. CDFA receives its allocation directly from the Department of Housing and Urban Development and administers CDBG funds for all communities across New Hampshire except for entitlement communities. CDFA provides the state with exceptionally cost-efficient...
Can you just define entitlement communities for the committee?
Yes, absolutely. So entitlement communities in New Hampshire include Manchester, Nashua, Portsmouth, Rochester, and Dover. CDFA provides the state with exceptionally cost-effective system for providing these resources to communities. CDFA is a financially self-sufficient and relies on fees from the programs we administer and the state's committed match to the CDBG program. The CDBG program is focused on the development of viable, sustainable, and equitable communities by providing affordable housing, suitable living environments, and expanding economic opportunities, primarily for low and moderate income persons in New Hampshire. CDBG funds in New Hampshire have leveraged tens of millions of dollars in matching capital. All eligible New Hampshire municipalities and counties have the opportunity to access $1.5 million in resources to support housing, public facility improvements, and economic development projects annually. In addition to requests for emergency and planning resources, which are not limited, projects that are awarded are community-driven efforts that local leaders and community members say are necessary within their municipality or region. CDFA staff administer competitive grant rounds throughout the year. All applications undergo extensive programmatic and financial reviews by CDFA staff. In addition, projects that meet all necessary criteria are voted on by an independent 11-member Community Development Advisory Committee and confirmed by CDFA's 11-member Board of Directors. All 22 of the New Hampshire citizens who review and approve these projects are appointed by the Governor and Council and represent a number of different sectors and communities involved in community development. Once CDFA's board recommends funding, the proposed awards are sent to the Executive Council for final approval. Federal funds come with significant requirements. CDFA's professional staff train and provide technical assistance to our grantees throughout the pre-application, application, and implementation phases of their project. We work closely with partners to find creative solutions and offer guidance on project development, as well as ease the burden of compliance and protect the investment of taxpayer funds. In calendar years 2018 and 2019, funds from the state CDBG program have improved the lives of nearly 2,500 people through public facility improvements and 613 people through emergency grants. Created and retained 98 livable wage jobs with benefits, rehabilitated or preserved 260 affordable and workforce housing units, and provided technical assistance to 602 micro businesses. It's worth noting through the CARES Act, the state of New Hampshire has been allocated approximately $14.3 million to be deployed by CDFA under the CDBG program in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. These funds are being used specifically for the prevention, preparation, and response to COVID-19.
by the end of the year. Approximately $4.5 million of these resources will be awarded to support communities in delivering high-priority critical services, such as direct grants to small businesses, child care, food banks, health and mental health centers, substance use services. A portion of these funds are directly going to micro businesses to grant to aid them through the crisis. CDFA respectfully requests the state of New Hampshire continue to provide federal required match funds, a total of $400,000 for the 2020-2023 state fiscal year. By doing so, we can deploy approximately $18.43 million of resources into New Hampshire for the community economic development projects that are so critical to our community. I want to thank you all for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Director. Do we have any questions for CDSA? Well, if we have any questions from the phone.
If you have a question on the phone, please press that on the side.
Commissioner Arlegos.
I just wanted to say what a great job you're doing, and I think so much better than your predecessor.
Thank you, Katie. I just want to note, in addition to the block grant that the state provides you, we also provide tax credits, which you use to also pull a portion of your federal tax. Approximately how much does the CDFA receive in state tax credits?
The CDFA administers $5 million of tax credits with allocations through competitive grant rounds to nonprofits. And we complement $200,000 a year with approximately $350,000 in additional funds to support the CDG program.
And that's the full that's the state match.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Seeing no questions on the phone, any other questions here in the room, Director Zellman?
Sorry. We recently made a change in state statute to the CDFA rules and how they apply to for Pondio or jail card. Can you just talk about your process and the board's process of implementing rules to be concurrent with the most recent program guide?
Absolutely. So in July of 2019, CDFA was exempt from the state rulemaking. The exemption has actually allowed us to successfully deploy the CARES Act funds. Without the exemption, we would have been bound, even with those funds, to those rules, making it possible to deploy those funds as quickly as they needed to be. So now we're going through a process of actually creating a five-year consolidated plan that will be adopted for the program year started July 1st, and that will really identify all the priorities across the state for the CDBG program for the next 5 years. We'll then develop annual action plans that call for the specific actions to be taken in any given year and the investments to be made. We'll have both those documents will include significant public impact input. We'll also be looking at things like the state health improvement program, health improvement plan, economic development data, the community progress data that we've pulled for all 234 municipalities, and take all that into consideration when we really identify where to make the most strategic investments. So that plan will be available. We make that approved, is first reviewed by the Community Development Advisory Committee and then approved by the Board of Directors. And it goes on record with administrative services so anybody can view that plan and also make comments for the coming year as we adopt a new action plan. So the exemption from state rulemaking has really just given us the flexibility to use public comments. In the past, we would take public comments, but because of the state rulemaking, and the conflict between the timing of making changes to the state rules and then the creation of this required five-year consolidated plan and the annual action plan, we weren't able to make changes to really make the most strategic investments. Now we're able to make those changes in a timely way, responding to public comment and ensuring that the program is most strategic.
Thank you. Anything further for CDFA? Seeing none, I'd like to thank you for the presentation. And I look forward to working together.
Thank you very much. You as well.
With that, I'd like to call the Public Utility Commission to their presentation.
morning, Cheryl. Would you be able to state your name to the record and then begin?
Good morning. My name is Diane Martin. I am the chairwoman of the Public Utilities Commission. The chair of the commission serves a dual role, serving both as the presiding officer for the regulatory body as well as the head of the agency that supports the commission's function. With me today by telephone are Deborah Howland, the executive director of the commission, as well as Julie Sillettier, the business administrator for the commission. We'll have this occasion talking up a little bit. The mission of the commission is an important one. We have a slide in that presentation that shows you the mission, but at a high level, it involves making sure that we all have electricity, gas, water, and sewer service that is safe, that we can rely on, and that comes at a price that is just and reasonable. As I have come to learn since joining the commission a year ago, the work of the commission in accomplishing that important mission is both broad and varied. It covers a wide range of topics from energy efficiency to rate making, and handles cases that run the gamut from simple hearings and public meetings that take an hour or two to cases that involve very significant legal issues that require lengthy proceedings that can last years. Importantly, it involves a significant amount of customer service, taking calls to the citizens of New Hampshire and helping to resolve their issues. It also involves vital safety work related to the gas pipelines in the state, as well as the Big Safe program and inspections and investigations to make sure our utilities are provided safely. The work of the commission is complex and challenging and requires both legal and financial expertise. The staff of the commission is comprised of a group of experts who are engineers, accountants, lawyers, and analysts, as well as an incredible support staff who work hard to make sure the commission is able to perform its duties. They are a bright, talented, and hardworking group. Before joining the Public Utilities Commission, I did not fully appreciate the volume of work done by the Public Utilities Commission. I have a few slides that give you some statistics about the work that was done in a given year. If you look at the docket open slide, it shows you that in fiscal year 20, a total of 181 dockets were opened. That means that a case or a petition or a complaint or an investigation required opening a docket and some form of proceeding had to occur related to it. The next page shows you the orders issued. In fiscal year 20, we have a total of 112 orders issued. Those can be single page orders, or they can be up to 60, 70 pages long and very detailed. Formal commission proceedings on the next page. For fiscal year 20, we had 46 formal commission proceedings. That's where we have an actual hearing, which has multi-day steps to it, pre-hearing conference, hearing, discovery. It entails a lot of resources. And the next slide shows you the inquiries made to the commission. This really highlights how important the commission is to the citizens of New Hampshire in serving them in addressing their concerns. You can see that in fiscal year 20, we got over 5,000 calls from New Hampshire citizens related to concerns for utilities. Those calls are all received by an individual person who works at the commission and responded to. On the next slide, we have safety. We have a safety division of the commission. In that division, we have experts who investigate and inspect utilities, particularly the pipeline safety, and ensure that safety standards are met. They've been related to COVID. They have worked with utilities to make sure that they have plans and procedures in place for COVID. The work that the safety division does is very varied and ranges from making sure that vegetation is cut properly on the sides of the road to working with the Homeland Security for emergency situations. On the next slide, you'll see significant proceedings. cases, but your standard rate case has a year by statute to be completed and can be very, very resource heavy. All right. During these times made challenging by COVID, we were asked by the governor to continue to provide the same level of service to the citizens of New Hampshire as efficiently as possible. The commission has met that challenge. We have continued to hold hearings, take calls from citizens, and inspect utilities. We have done all of that while cutting costs wherever possible and eliminating non-essential spending. I am very proud to say that the commission is as productive as it ever has been, despite these challenging times. The commission received no general fund. Instead, the commission received funding from several sources. If you look at the next slide, titled Expenses versus Revenues, you'll see that the vast majority of our expenses are for personnel. That's for the people who answer the telephone when an assistant calls, and for the experts who do all the work related to rate cases. The revenues chart shows you that the majority of our revenues come from utility assessments. Federal funds also are a significant piece that fund our safety division. In preparing this budget, we looked at every single item to determine whether it was truly necessary and developed a budget that met the targets set by the governor. Our efficiency budget is $25,901,175 for fiscal year 22 and $26,307,610 for fiscal year 23, both of which are below their respective target amounts. The commission has identified two prioritized needs beyond its efficiency budget. The remaining prioritized needs in our efficiency budget are requests from DOIC and DAP. The most critical need identified by the commission is the establishment of a cybersecurity position in our safety division. Cybersecurity is the greatest threat at this time to utility infrastructure. This position would add a component to our safety division for inspection, reviews, interaction with federal government agencies related to cybersecurity. That is why we put that position in as a priority. Moving on to the Site Evaluation Committee. The Site Evaluation Committee is administratively attached to the commission, and the chair of the Public Utilities Commission is also the chair of the Site Evaluation Committee. RSA 162H provides that the committee can hire an administrator who is an unclassified state employee, or in the alternative, that position may be filled by an independent contractor. The committee has historically employed an administrator. However, the administrator position is currently vacant. During fiscal year 21, the Site Evaluation Committee had one project, Chinook Solar LLC. Chinook involves consideration of a 30-megawatt solar facility located in Fitzwilliam. The application fee for the Chinook project was $60,000. The efficiency budget for the Site Evaluation Committee is $286,016 for fiscal year 22 and $292,134 for fiscal year 23, both of which meet the governor's targets. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chairman, for your presentation. Do we have any questions for the Public Utilities Commission? I'll ask them as names to the phone.
We have a question on the phone.
Director Zala. Thank you, Chairman. I just want to share comments I've made with all of the agencies that are assessment funded, and I'll say the same to labor when they come up, that I'm a big supporter and fan of using assessment to fund these government services as we decide what the appropriate spend is and then assess the relevant community for the cost. But in order for assessments to be an appropriate use of government taxing power, we have to ensure we really control the expenses and we're only including costs that are truly appropriate. So I thank you and your team for your work in finding efficiencies and finding savings and ensuring that those paying the utilities assessments are really getting their best bang.
Absolutely. I think although utility assessments are not a tax, they are certainly paid by the citizens of New Hampshire, and it's important that we keep them to a minimum as much as possible.
Chair, another question. This one related to COVID-19 and how it impacted
relationship the commission has with the essential workers in the energy industry. Could you just speak a little bit to how the pandemic has impacted the commission's planning with those critical workers, and also speaking to the cyber position that you have prioritized need, how cyber attacks and the COVID-19 pandemic have gone to some extent hand in hand when it comes to the energy sector?
I think that our safety division has actually been able to maintain its relationships with the utility essential workers, or even they're probably more closely related at this point. They more regularly meet with the utilities, depending on the time in the pandemic, to make sure that staff are available, that precautions are being taken so that essential workers remain healthy, facilitating locations for utility workers to be quarantined, that kind of thing, helping to set up the features that ensure that essential workers remain healthy. So I would say that they have worked probably more closely than ever because of the pandemic. And we haven't seen in New Hampshire the cyber impacts that yet that have occurred related to the pandemic, but for utilities. But overall, I would say that the risk is deemed to be heightened, that cyber attacks in general have certainly increased during the pandemic. And so cyber position is very timely considering what's going on.
Thank you. And another question is related to the SEC. You mentioned that position is vacant. Obviously, the duties of that position are largely driven by applications under the SEC's jurisdiction. Do you see, and you mentioned the two options that the commission has, that if you've been a contractor or filling a vacancy, based on any type of forecast of development that the commission can foresee, do you have a sense of which pathway is going to be a better pathway with biennium?
I think the funding of the Administrator for the Site Evaluation Committee is difficult, or the way to provide the services and fund it is a difficult question, because it is not possible to predict the projects that will come in. And so we are sort of at the mercy of the market and whether or not businesses are interested in proposing those types of projects. In addition, we had an issue related to where the funding comes from for the administrator, and the statute provides that it needs to come from the general fund. And so we now have two forms of funding, general fund for those static costs related to administration, and then costs related to particular projects, which are intended to come from the fee. I think it really comes down to trying to assess whether or not there will be projects, but continuing to fund it an administrator position without knowing that there will be projects is problematic. And at this moment, we just finished the only project we had this year. It was not a very big project, and I am not aware of other projects that are already coming down the line, although we recently had some inquiries about other solar projects. So it's a difficult situation to address, and I do think that it's something that we need to look at more closely and determine whether, if we're going to fund it through fees, whether there are different fees that need to be considered, or whether or not we just don't have an administrator on a regular basis, because having that cost all the time when you don't necessarily have the need for it is a problem. Although the maintenance and operation pieces that go on after the certificate are continuing work that the administrator does when they are working with us. So it's really something that I think needs to be looked at closely to determine the best approach.
Thank you, Commissioner. And looking at page 61, which is Form E for the SEC, that speaks to that same challenge as to whether or not we should explore a change in either the source funds or the tools that are available to the Commission's disposal in instances like that.
Yes, and this actually comes out of similar language from the last biennium, but I don't think this will need to do more to address the situation.
Anything further for the PUC? Commissioner Rogers.
I just wanted to say hi. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you.
I miss you too. Okay. Well, thank you everyone for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Chairwoman. I just want to add that Grandma has the distinction of being the head of three different, two state agencies and one component unit. She's got the record for running the most organizations since state government. Would you like to support?
No, thank you. I was going to say that. That's right. I haven't slept in a year.
Thank you, Chairwoman.
Thank you.
With that, I would like to call the Office of the Consumer Advocate.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dean Maurice Priest, sometimes called John Priest. I'm the head of the Office of the Consumer Advocate. While Chairwoman Martin is still in the room, I would just like to thank her and the Public Utilities Commission. We're administratively attached to the PUC, and the PUC has been extremely helpful, particularly Chairwoman Martin, since she took office, and that has helped us operate in an efficient and effective manner. Our task, pursuant to our enabling statute, which is RSA 263-28, is to represent the interests of residential utility customers. And we do that primarily at the Public Utilities Commission by participating as a party in the PUC's major proceedings. But that is by no means the entirety of what we do. Our statute says that we can basically represent the state's residential utility customers before any forum. And we are active before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Regional Transmission Organization, ISO New England, and its stakeholder, quote unquote, advisory group, the New England Power Pool. And of course, we pursue matters in court as necessary. We appear all the time at the State House for the general court, and really, I go anywhere where I think our interests are implicated. We, like the Public Utilities Commission, are funded by utility assessment. We have no federal funds, so basically every cent that is expended on my office is ultimately charged to the state's ratepayers. And because of that, although the assessment is not a tax, we are very mindful of the fact that our constituents pay our costs, and we try to be very careful with the resources that we have. My office employs five people full-time. And just as a sanity check, I looked this morning at my counterpart over in Maine, the Office of the Public Advocate. They have eight full-time people serving the state that's roughly about the same size as ours population plans. We submitted an efficiency budget to the governor, even though we are not general funded. And what we did by way of an efficiency budget to meet the budget targets is we wiped out the amount of money that all the money we spend on outside consultants who help us. Unlike PUC, which is much bigger than us, we it's hard to chop away at anything other than full-time equivalents or major contracts. So the way to meet the budget targets for us, given our administrative overhead costs and trying to avoid being delayed by the office by basically wiping out our consulting budget, that is going to have a significant and negative impact on the scope of what we are able to do, particularly because we also have to wipe out our travel budget, which will inhibit our ability to participate once the world gets somewhat back to normal in all of the regional meetings where so much policy is made and so much money changes hands, it ultimately comes from ratepayers. And so if we were to restore some of that via a prioritized needs budget, it would amount to restoring some or all of our consulting budget. And with any luck, as the economy bounces back and as the world returns to normal, we may be able to do that. If you ask me what good the OCA does, I would say that the chief good that we do is we make life easier for the Public Utilities Commission. The PUC's job is to serve as the arbiter by statute between the interests of utility shareholders and utility customers. We put weight on the scale on the side of utility customers and thereby make PUC proceedings efficient, more thorough, and ultimately that means the PC is able to make more decisions that are fair and balanced. Most of the major cases that we participate in are rate cases. Rate cases are fundamentally backward-looking. You look at a so-called test year of utility expenses, and you use that to determine what just and reasonable rates are. There are a few things that are fundamentally future-oriented, and frankly, I think those are more consequential in the long run for residential utility customers, and those have to do with, well, here at the state level, the advent of community power aggregation, which will allow municipalities to become essentially the energy agents of their citizens and businesses. A statewide utility customer data platform that will move forward pursuant to a bill that Governor Sununu signed into law in 2019. And regionally, the initiative is being pursued by the New England States Committee on Energy, which of course represents all the state's governors for ISO New England. And they are rolling out, I think, what I would call a major initiative to open up ISO New England and make it more publicly accountable and more responsive to the policy needs of the state. We look forward to being actively involved in that as it moves forward. With that, since I know I only have 5 minutes on your schedule, I think I should just stop and ask indicate my willingness to answer any questions that you all might have about us.
Thank you, Mr. Priest. Do we have any questions on the phone or the Office of Consumer Advocate? I'll start off with a question. And obviously, your office is very involved in most recent proceedings to the Energy Efficiency Resource Standard, which, for those that might not be aware, is the state's primary mechanism for funding energy efficiency targets. I guess my question for you, Mr. Priest, is how do you see the state doing with its own investments in energy efficiency? And is there anything that your office would recommend the state might do to help practice overreach?
Well, unfortunately, New Hampshire is regionally dead last when it comes to its commitment to energy efficiency. You have to go all the way to Delaware before you get to a state that has a lower rating than we do, at least according to the scorecard put out every year by the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. I think energy efficiency is the single best thing that I can deliver to the constituency that I represent, because megawatts are simply cheaper than megawatts are. And so when we squeeze another unit of energy savings out of the system, we save customers money in the long run. And when we allow ourselves to lag behind our neighbors, we're losing some of our competitive edge, because that means we are not employing as many people in energy efficiency, which is all local stuff performed by local people, and doesn't export any wealth that we generate by way of energy efficiency. And of course, we're falling behind in the competitive race to be as uncostly as possible to energy consumers. We do have an energy efficiency resource standard, which means that the Public Utilities Commission has adopted a goal of all cost effective energy efficiency. We are in the thick right now of an administrative proceeding to determine what the dimensions of our energy efficiency plan and goals will be in the upcoming triennium, starts on January 1, and we just spent 2 very intense days trying to settle that proceeding with all the stakeholders, and those discussions are still ongoing.
Thank you, Mr. Priest. I guess as far as investing in state building energy efficiency, is there anything that you might recommend for us to explore during the budget process?
You know, the challenge with energy efficiency is that it requires commitments that create long-term good. So the challenge is, I think the state has done a great job, at least since I've been in office, of making its fleet of buildings as energy efficient as possible. And others, the state can look as aggressively as it can at that possibility, because it pays dividends over many, many decades.
Thank you. Representative Wyler, a question.
Thank you. Mr. Kreese, has your agency made any comment on the renewable portfolio standard and its effect on our electric rates?
There is no question that when you monetize the cost of environmental externalities, that exerts upward pressure on people's utilities. I tend to treat things like the renewable portfolio standards and any other initiatives like that, you know, the regional greenhouse gas initiative, but things like that, as outside my bailiwick. I think that's constants are the variables for purposes of the algebra, because I'm not an environmental policy maker. I think that's in the general report, and if the general report believes that a renewable portfolio standard is important public policy for the state, then I accept it.
Now, the second question, how much do transport costs have to do with our energy efficiency, because we don't have the pipelines that might bring the gas and the oil to us at a lower cost?
We are able at present, I believe, to provide our natural gas generation fleet in New England with the fuel that they need to operate. The challenge comes from on an extremely cold day in the winter when every natural gas heating customer is exerting its primary claim on what's available through the pipelines. And of course, all the gas generators want to run as well. So far, we have not had a crisis where anything has been unavailable to generate. The Regional Transmission Organization, ISO New England, has so-called paper performance rules in effect that are effective, I think, in keeping the generators viable on those really extreme days during the winter. So, we are paying for those initiatives. And, you know, again, I think when we buy energy efficiency megawatts instead of megawatts, that keeps the cost of electricity down and it fends off the need to build new generation capacity, or frankly, new pipeline capacity, which is very, very expensive. As you probably know, it has become essentially impossible to build new interstate pipelines that come into New England from the southwest. Apparently, New York State is a big. New York State is a competitor to doing that. And so we and the. There won't be a future in the new pipeline. We're planning accordingly.
Is there a possibility as I drive through the states, I see big gas tanks that store the gas. If we had such facilities in our state, we could take care of this, you know, sometimes super demand on just a very few days.
That is something that Liberty Utilities was planning to do in Epping. As you probably know, they were going to build a huge, $2 billion cubic foot tank in Epping, and they decided that they didn't need to do that. So I guess I defer to their expertise when it comes to something.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Anything further for the Office of Consumer Advocate? Dr. Zellman, who has noted in a prior proceeding that the smaller agencies get thrown up, accounting is in line, and the larger agencies talk more broadly. So I apologize. Your Class 233 litigation expenses. These are for, it's kind of somewhat analogous to your class 46s for consultants, correct? This is not the state bringing suit, that's our actual litigation. This is outside expert to assist the office in your deliberation before the PC.
That's exactly right. First, for my purposes, I probably shouldn't say this to the budget director, but the consulting line and the litigation line essentially fund the same amount of initiatives. So in that sense, to me, they're fund.
Anything further, Commissioner Arlington?
Just one last question. If all of your prioritized needs were granted, how many dollars of those are general fund dollars?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Creed.
Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today.
With that, we will call the Department of Business and Economic Affairs, DEA. Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioner Castle. Would you be able to introduce yourself for the record, even though I somewhat just did, and begin your presentation?
I'm Taylor Castle. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Business and Economic Affairs and former Director of Community Development Finance.
As you know, BEA was established in 2017. We have a total of 125 staff and 27 unfilled positions currently. BEA brings a broad and holistic approach to its work, seeking to connect with businesses and partners across the state as we work to create communities and an economy that represent places that people want to live, visit, work. To do that, we have integrated the work and services of our department over the past 2 years to create a new and effective tool for the state in growing its economy. For example, using the investments and marketing expertise of our tourism division and applying to the need to recruit more workforce to fill jobs here in the state, designing new opportunities for the state to better align economic support systems and provide a focused value to employers through workforce development, training, technical and financial support, planning and regulatory assistance, and taking full advantage of what New Hampshire offers and marketing a compelling case for new businesses, new residents, and keeping more graduates in our state. Since March of last year, BEA's mission has been focused on the economic impacts and recovery initiatives related to the COVID-19 pandemic. We have retooled our teams to play important leadership and support roles along with our sister agencies across state government. Some of the highlights of that work include leading all communications with state business community related, state community businesses related to operational guidance, access to programs, and producing PPE for fellow businesses. Our staff over that period of time has responded to over 10,000 calls, emails, and web interviews. And our website has had over 1 million hits during this time. BEA is the lead agency, lead for emergency support function 18 at the Emergency Operations Center, and they're leading the state effort to connect local manufacturers to others with PPE needs within the state and among our business community. We've created partnerships with statewide chambers of commerce to advance initiatives aimed at improving the environment for economic recovery. We have developed a public service campaign called Don't Go Viral, to urge the use of masks and social distancing among high-risk younger populations using outdoor marketing and social media. And we have been leading the governor's task force on reopening the economy since April, and recently I have been double-timing as the director of Gopher, and our staff has been heavily utilized in support of that organization, to mention the fact that we share office space. In terms of BEA's organization, we have two divisions, the Economic Development and Travel Tourism Divisions. Within DEV, we do business recruitment and expansion work. We do have our Office of International Commerce that works with small and medium-sized businesses looking to access international markets. Our Office of Workforce Opportunity administers the state's Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act funds and serves as the Workforce Development Policy Center for the state. And our Office of Procurement Technical Assistance Center helps different small businesses in the state access federal contracts. Our Division of Travel and Tourism manages all departmental marketing, public relations, and advertising, primarily as it relates to supporting the state's hospitality industry, which, as you know, has been severely impacted by this pandemic. We also manage the state welcome centers through our Bureau of Visitor Services and have two newly authorized offices for the Office of Outdoor Economy and Offshore Wind Economic Development. Overall, BEA's request this year is 7.7% less in FY22 than the current fiscal budget, FY21 budget, which is a reduction of about $1.3 million. We've achieved these reductions through reduced travel budgets, staff and program reductions, and include the request, but it does include a request for level funding in our marketing budget, so I'll mention later. Our largest reduction by percentage is in the Bureau of Visitor Services, which is proposing a reduction of 16%. Our welcome centers were closed during the height of the pandemic in order to protect our staff and in response to severe reductions in travel and public. When compared with other priorities in economic development and our state tourism marketing, we believe this reduction is justified at this time. In addition, before this pandemic, BVS was having difficulty in finding enough staff, which continued. Most of the positions are part-time and paid below $12 an hour.
accommodate this, we have reduced hours at some of our at some centers to focus on peak travel periods. On a general basis, this means we are open from Thursday to Monday during holidays and vacation to maintain service on those days regardless of the day of the week. And high travel areas such as Hooks Head and Seabrook remain open 7 days. In terms of priority areas, two areas I would highlight. First is marketing. As I mentioned earlier, the state tourism industry, our second largest industry, has been severely impacted by the COVID pandemic. While we did see some busy weekends through the summer, the year as a whole has not been anywhere near a normal tourism year. This past summer, BEA maintained spending and advertising budget only at about 58% of our normal budget, but doing that has paid off in our view. For the first time, we had a strong focus on marketing to New Hampshire residents, urging them to vacation in their own backyard while maintaining brand awareness in other areas of the Northeast. That marketing influenced this summer $169 million in trip spending at a cost of only 16 cents per view, where the average is 51 cents. That's on our social media and digital marketing. Other states did not maintain their tourism positions, and I believe that that will come back with them as we look at coming out of the pandemic in time for this year's tourism season. I want to reiterate that the competition for tourism dollars this coming year will be intense. It will be critical for New Hampshire to support our tourism and hospitality industry in that competition. Most industry groups and businesses will have to make their own very difficult budget decisions, and we feel strongly that the state should play a role in helping them get back on their feet and getting their people back to work. Allowing our state tourism division to continue its work competitively marketing the state will be a leg up for our industry in that stiff competition with other industries. The benefits of the strong industry coming out of this pandemic will pay dividends in years. As we all know, every tourism dollar spent in New Hampshire provides a major part of residents to the meals and rentals tax. In fact, our research this past summer tells us that $10.28 was returned in revenue for every dollar we spent on our market. Final point on marketing is our joint promotional program, or JPK. And we currently have this program on pause due to budget considerations, but I believe this program will be increasingly important to our local and regional partners as part of the strategy I just discussed. And our request, just as a reminder, the request for that program will be $1 million, and that is a 50-50 match program. The second critical area I will briefly discuss is our work to continue to improve and advance our economic development initiatives and strategies. Some examples of that in those areas. Adopting new strategies in the face of COVID that will leverage the long-term strategy, such as the very successful partnership we have with New Hampshire Employment Security and virtual job fairs over the last couple of weeks. It's had a huge impact and a lot of participation. We've been running virtual job fairs for small businesses to access, again, international markets when we can't physically have anyone here or meet anyone overseas. Remote business recruitment continues, and in fact, I would say that a lot of our activity in business recruitment has been retained despite the COVID pandemic, and we continue to see investment in expansion in New Hampshire, and we've introduced tools to be able to allow our staff to continue to do that work remotely. And we've implemented a new web-based service platform used to respond to all of those businesses that have been reaching out to us in order to get them the answers they need quickly and effectively. We are also advancing and formalizing coordination with other partners around the state. As a result of the COVID impact, we've had much more regular contact with, for instance, chambers of commerce and the municipal economic development directors and officials from around the state. And that has drastically improved the platform for all the information sharing we've had through this period. And I expect to fully continue either on our remote platform, such as Zoom, but in person, hopefully at some point in the not too distant future. And I would also point out one of our members of the Council of Partner Agencies, the CDFA, was just here a little while ago. We've been really using that organization, which is made up of CDFA, the Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, the Business Finance Authority, and the university system and the community college system, to meet regularly and talk about all of these issues. And I would say, over the last couple of months, those discussions and meetings have been heavily tilted towards the work we were doing in response to the state's economic response to COVID. And lastly, we are evolving our delivery service to the business community. We're reorganizing ourselves internally and externally, aimed at providing our entire economic and community development system benefits. We established and hired a new state workforce development director in our office of workforce opportunity to direct policies and work closely with our partners in employment security and external. And legislature approved the establishment of the Outdoor Recreation Industry Development Office about 2 years ago to connect our outdoor recreation and natural resources to our economic development strategy of attracting business, workforce, students, and more investment in that fast-growing sector. In conclusion, I believe that this all represents the real estate budget, given the balance between the current pandemic, state revenue challenges, and the needs for our services to support the business community and our economy with an eye toward the other side of COVID. And the role that we can play to put New Hampshire's economy in the best possible position to have a head start for what will undoubtedly be an economic competition for investment, workforce, and business with our neighboring states, competition like we've probably not seen for many years. With all that, I look forward to all that competition as well as working with all of you on the budget to get us there and that. Working with our staff at PDA, make all that come together. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Caswell. I'd like to thank you for your work leading Gopher as well. It's been a pleasure working together on that initiative. I do have several questions on the budget. PDA is one of very few agencies in the state that has a commissioner's office accounting unit that's split between two lines. I believe it's just you and Stacey. I didn't have a chance to ask Stacey this question, so I'm going to ask you this question. In the commissioner's office, you have 220010 and 220017. In 17, all that's there is the turnpike funds. Is there a reason the turnpike funds broken out in a separate accounting unit in the commissioner's office?
So what we did in our previous budget was we moved the Bureau of Visitor Services and the work that it does, the Welcome Center, from the Travel and Tourism Division to the Commissioner's Office. And the reason for that was that that was kind of a holdover from the split of today. And that and it was our judgment that an organization such as Travel and Tourism, which is really geared toward marketing and outreach and the types of activities that they do, we're not really in a position to properly manage an operational function like BDS. So we moved that to the commissioner's office. So I work directly with Bob Lachan, who is the chief of that office. And that office is funded partially by general funds and partially by Bureau of
Thank you. Another question. I lost the page number here, but one of your targets in this buying industry increase meals and rooms tax revenue by 5%. Could you just speak to where that compares historically, that large increase year over year, and just some of the strategic investments that the department is making?
Well, I think traditionally that's a number that is probably consistent over the last couple of years. We really feel, and we're able to now, with the data research that we have and the advent of digital marketing, it's not that difficult for us to be able to draw straight lines between the investments that we make to the revenue that's realized by the state. So as I mentioned, just in the summer where we had a reduced amount of dedicated funds towards marketing, we were approaching $11 in return for the dollar that came from that fund.
Thank you. And my last question before I'll turn it over to my counterparts. On the economic development side, could you explain the relationship that your department has with the Northern Borders Regional Commission?
Of course. So I am the governor's alternate through to the NBRC, which is a federal entity that is a little unique in that the management and the leadership of that organization is equally split between states, member states, which are New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, and the federal government. At this time, Governor Sununu is the state co-chair of the NBRC. So the role that we play is one representing the state of New Hampshire at on the commission. Our department also manages the various funding programs that NBRC offers. So there are right now two major programs. There's the Regional Forest Partnership Program, and then there is the regular EIB grant program that we also manage. So that takes a good
you know, half a year worth of staff time on our side to be able to administer.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions for PEA? Director Zellman.
Thank you. I think I can help answer the reason the Office of Commissioners is split. We moved to the Commissioner mentioned, we moved the film office into the Commissioner's office. I believe we split it to make the reporting requirements of Turnpike funds easier. I moved to Joe Bouchard, RSA 918 or something, mm-hmm. that stipulates the reporting requirements for using Turnpike funds. So,
Joe Bouchard, I would say that that's accurate. Anytime you see a split funded account with the same accounting and title, it's related to me. Make us all their work on budget every day, clearly understand the funding source, and also comply with whatever statute applies to the source of funds.
So it is a little bit wonky, but the term by fund is unique enough. But I think that's why you're only looking at safety and MEA. I do have a question on your marketing expenses. The department is instructed to request, I believe, 3.1% of the prior year's yield and runs waterfall calculation after certain transfers, but 3.1% yield and runs revenue as part of the travel improvement development fund. It looks like in fiscal year 2022, you're requesting between your efficiency and prioritized needs 13.5 and then 13.6 in fiscal year 2023. Just as we're seeing M&R go down. So this reflects not what the statute instructs you to do, but what you see as an appropriate expenditure, because again, it's greater than the 3.1%.
Right. So, yes, you're correct. The percentage is 3.15%, and I believe the statute says that we're to request a minimum of 3.15%. So, given the situation that we are looking at, and it's really unique structuring of that number, because when you want to be able to support the industry, you'd probably be in a time where you would see reduced revenue. So I think that's why there's that makes it a minimum number. We'll try to make the case that that's an important investment for the state's making. So we went to a, but it's effectively a levelized fund from the previous year.
Any questions on the phone for DEA?
If you have a question, please comment inside.
Commissioner Aramis.
Well, we wait to see if anybody hits spotting on the star. Council of Partner Agencies, the corporate division of the Secretary of State's office isn't one?
No.
Why?
Well, it was a statutory insertion, as you'll recall, when we put together that.
My memory is not very good.
Oh, come on. So, we were originally, the university system was not included. Last year, the legislature passed to include the university system. But no, we haven't included any other agencies beyond that.
I'm just thinking in terms of business sort of one stop. I know that has a different meaning in state parlance, but I'm starting a business in New Hampshire. I got to come over and stand in the rain and one of the units and let somebody come down and help me register. And then I go up across the street. Is there your relationship between the two, though, is pretty strong?
I think that that subject is something that is very much worth more discussion on, is particularly in light of how other states have been able to handle their business registration and all of the functions that go with starting a business. I think that there's probably some room to make improvements in that system in the interim. So it's something that's been on the docket, it's something that we're looking forward to discussing. The acceptance of the question process, but the extent that it's relevant, we can certainly go on that conversation.
Anything further for BEA? Seeing that, I'd like to thank you, Taylor.
Yeah.
I'll see you on Thursday.
Yep. I feel like I should do the special lead-in for Commissioner Mary. He's the last one, right?
He is the last one that we will call. This will be the Department of Labor. They've been a good 3 days so far. I look forward to finishing on a high note.
Good luck with that. Thanks for coming to
talk. And Taylor, no, we didn't need to talk about your time to the FAA, so you're welcome. Good morning, Commissioner. Would you be able to state your name for the record and begin your presentation?
Sure. For the record, I'm Ken Merrifield, Commissioner of the Department of Labor, and in case you have any difficult questions, I brought Deputy Commissioner Marie Arden as well. The Department of Labor consists of three divisions: administration, inclusive of department-wide efforts like human resources and finance, inspection, which is tasked with the enforcement of safety, employment and safety, and notably elevator and pressure vessel statutes, and worker compensation division tasked with monitoring the state's worker compensation system. The inspection division is responsible for administering and enforcing such laws as protective legislation law, citizens job protection law, whistleblowers protection act, youth employment and minimum wage laws, etc. Along with these laws, the division also enforces administrative rules dealing with payment of wages, health and safety, etc. In each of the last three fiscal years, that division has recovered in excess of $1 million in wages for new entry employees, completed an average of 750 labor inspections of businesses, completed roughly 10,000 boiler or pressure vessel inspections, and over 5,000 elevator inspections. The division is also proactive, training approximately 2,500 employers per year on employment law to assist businesses with compliance, 2020 being the exception as a public health emergency forced cancellation of our usual spring in-person trainings. The division did develop and conduct remote electronic training this year, and will continue to offer that service to employers in the future. The Workers' Compensation Division is the largest division, and was created in 1947 as responsibility for administering the state's worker compensation law. Originally enacted in 1911, this law requires employers to maintain insurance coverage, provide no-fault workers' compensation for employees in case of accident, injury, death, or occupational disease arising out of the course of their employment. Among other duties, the division collects first reports of injury from employers and insurance carriers in New Hampshire regarding the roughly 30,000 to 40,000 injuries that occur in the state every year. It conducts over 1,500 formal hearings per year, and manages revolving trust fund collections and payments of nearly $20 million per year, which is notably about double the size of our entire operating budget. While the department's total appropriations are funded 100% by agency income, that revenue is derived through two distinct sources, the administration fund and the restricted. The administration fund is described in RSA 281-859 and comes from a pro rata assessment of the department's annual budget for worker compensation activities and is levied on the workers' compensation insurance carriers and self-funded entities in New Hampshire. The restricted fund described in RSA 273-1B comes from the sum of all other fees, licenses, certificates, and civil penalties of the department. The balance of the restricted fund is also notably transferred to the general fund at the end of the fiscal year after our operating costs are paid. In attendees of this hearing 2 years ago, I recall that the Labor Department adopted a new cost allocation plan so that the burden on either of these two funding sources can be traced to measurable statistics within our operation. We've continued, I think, to improve on that model in this new budget request. A number of expenses that were budgeted in each division, remember, we're a $10 million program, and so we had costs spread throughout the department in various divisions, like everybody needs a telephone, everyone needs technology, everyone
room needs to pay the rent to Charlie, so they have office space. We have, in this budget request, we've centralized those costs in the administration division. And we think this will do a number of things. It's going to make us more efficient in the budget office, certainly. It's going to reduce the chance of duplicative purchasing by the divisions. And also, I believe it's going to increase our general fund contribution at the end of the year, because the funding allocation method in administration is better for the state, shall we say. So we will actually be able to turn up a more amount to the general fund as a result of this accounting change. So the governor's office provided an overall expense target of $9.5 million for year one, representing a 10% or $1 million decrease from our current adjusted authorized in 2021. The adjusted year two target was about $670,000 lower than this year's current operating budget, and we've met both targets with our efficiency budget request. I think if you look at department-wide class lines, these reductions have impacted four classes most profoundly, those being salaries, benefits, division of department of information technology, transfers, and post-retirement benefits. It represents the entirety of our reduction. So in addition to our decision to add no new positions for 2022-23, we've also defunded 17 out of 92 positions in the department. While this does remove significant staffing flexibility, the department has also been restructuring its organization in recent years, and will be able, I believe, to operate normally. We have traditionally carried a number of vacancies in the department anyway. So I do not see this as a significant problem defunding 17 positions. DOIT staffing, I should also mention, has been reduced from 5 full-time direct staff to 2 full-time direct staff, and 1 full-time and 1 part-time DOIT staff have been requested back in prioritized needs. We expect to launch our new on-base document management system in early 2021. Expect to realize operational improvements as a result of doing that. What we feel we need in the new biennium, rather than deeper staffing, is actually operational flexibility, and we've attempted to provide for that through better funding some of our operational investments. All that said, as I mentioned, we do have some significant prioritized needs that we've requested. The highest two priorities for us include enhancements for the new on-base system. The first would add functionality that will improve our customers' experience with the department and further increase our speed, response time, productivity. The second would migrate the labor department completely off of our aging AS400 IBM mainframe, so that OnBase would then become our only system and our system of record. This is a complex migration, as the IBM is currently our system of record for virtually everything we do, including all case management and receivables of revenue. Priority three is funding for the chief elevator inspector, which has been unfunded in order for us to meet target, while we do have 2.5 full-time equivalents. In the elevator section, we acknowledge the importance of having a chief to properly lead and supervise these functions. Priority four is funding requested by Charlie and administrative services to be paid through the rental of the swallowing building. Priority five is funding previously mentioned for the one full-time and one part-time direct staff with the OIC. And that concludes my remarks, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Commissioners. We have any questions for the Department of Labor? I'll send out people on the phone one last time as well.
If you're on the phone, you have a question.
Oh, we don't have Director Dell.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Rudy. I think you heard what I said to PUC about the appropriateness of assessment, so I'm not going to repeat it verbatim, but I think the work that you guys have done over this current biennium and proposing this as soon as I am really is exemplary. I mean, you know your class lines better than most commissioners. I think coming from HHS, where you manage to take a particularly larger budget, has
taken it easy by comparison.
But the Department of Labor is a fascinating historic entity, and there's a myriad of different statutes and programs and any dedicated funds that you all oversee. So your work to straighten things out, budget responsibly and accordingly, is really noted. So thank you for your work. And again, you know, the department typically underspends its budget, so you know, trying to budget more accurately and then requesting truly what you see as the additional needs is exactly what the governor has all agencies with, so thank you for following up on that. But so there was a question there in there. The second injury fund.
Yes.
That double the size of your agency budget.
Essentially. I would say if you look at actual expenditures in SIF over the last 2 years, it actually has been rising again. However, the five-year trend prior to that was a decline of $1 million a year. So anywhere from 16 to 20 million.
As a self-employed, self-insured entity, does the state pay into the second year?
It does.
Anything further for the Department of Labor? Indeed, I'd like to thank you both for the presentation.
You bet. Thank you so much.
Look forward to working together.
Great to be working with you too. Thank you, Matt, for everything. And then we're not.
Director Zell.
So just on the other two budgets that we're not hearing in front of us, I know that members of the legislature know this, but just around the semblance that we've finished with the package, the judicial bench not received targets from the governor. They were informed of generally what the executive branch agencies were receiving targets, and they strove to make cost reductions. The governor will be including their budget as submitted for the legislature's consideration on any changes or additions. The state and the legislature, we have not had any conversations with the legislative branch, and as is prior practice in history, the governor will propose the current finance budget once again, and the legislature will make any changes or additions to their own budget. Just for the members of the House, and when the legislature lapses into four dedicated funds, there's a significant balance in those funds. So as executive branch agencies are looking to make pretty significant reductions, and there is a possibility to provide assistance to the other state agencies by looking at the legislature's own savings. I believe there's $14 million currently as well.
I appreciate being invited to this and enjoyed the presentations and look forward to working with them when we get to the Finance Committee and expect to see who both to bring some changes to what we talked about.
Sure, I have a question. I have that, and that brings up those. Does the legislative branch pay out those funds for some of the maintenance that we do in the areas that we occupy in the state? That would be, for example, the House meeting area, the House representatives area.
So in the last budget, as you'll recall, the we made an effort to standardize how we charge agencies, whether they're generally funded or not generally funded. So the allocation went everywhere. And the judicial branch obviously does pay for your court facilities, is a big thing. The one exception for that, actually probably two exceptions. We have to the governor's office.
You do not.
So who should I
go?
So we decided not to charge the governor's office because we thought somebody would give us our hands for that. And although we could talk about that, and we don't charge the legislature. That said, so the legislature, you know, in general services budget 2950 is accounting it to pay most of those charges, and it's largely generally funded for that reason, without assessments for the legislature. There are significant costs that Terry does out of God knows where he gets the money.
but pays for like the massive, you know how it looks like a bomb off in front of the LOD?
Yeah, the stairs were failing in the homes. And
yeah, so that's out of pseudo capital funds. They aren't technically capital funds, but it's money given to the legislature in lieu of capital funds.
So,
and I think it comes out of those.
So that money is coming out of those accounts that Matt spoke about?
My understanding, Representative, that with the permission of the Joint Legislative Committee on Facilities, so there's four accounts, one account in the Senate, and then two in the LPA. I don't know which account they chose to pull funds from, but the Joint Legislative Committee did approve a withdrawal from those funds to cover the construction project.
Yeah, okay, that seems appropriate. Thank you, Mayor.
It's a $1.6 million capital project, essentially a capital project of fixing steps, and it's coming out of that. Occasionally, there will be money that the capital budget thinks of spending, and then at some point during the House or Senate phase, you know, there are many examples like the roof and whatnot. Typically, somebody usually carry will go to the legislature and say, can you just move that out of the capital budget into our direct control, so they don't have to follow the same, rules and regulations that the executive branch agencies, when we build stuff, have a lot of regulations we have to follow. And I think it's easier from their standpoint than not.
Well, I'm not sure whether we should follow the regulations, but if we have our lasting money into accounts, we definitely should be paying to the other people, in my opinion. Matt, I'd like to echo that Ken and I appreciate having staff through these hearings. They've been very informative. You guys have quite a bit of work before it comes to us, so good luck.
Did I hear a figure that we've saved by the travel, not having 300 plus people travel up to Concord on a regular basis? And did we figure out how much money we've saved in travel to Austin Center?
I also heard that has been calculated. I have not seen that, and I did not see that. I think the House clerk may have looked at the prior terms.
Yeah, but I mean, compared to what it normally be.
I have more money to talk to Mr. Senator at one time. And I'm not doing
it. But, you know, there was a lot fewer sessions that we get.
At this point, I would like to thank our hosts, the Department of Transportation, support from Homeland Security Emergency Management, everyone who tuned in on the phone, including the one question we got on the phone at the very beginning of this hearing on Thursday. I would like to thank Representative Over and Wyler for their attendance here, along with any House and Senate members that joined us virtually on the phone. I'd like to thank Dr. Zellum for his leadership through this process thus far. I look forward to picking up that high bar and holding it right there. Anything else before we wrap up, Commissioner Monahan?
Can we all agree that we're going to send a note to Commissioner Safety that Marie deserves a raise?